Dawson.
Uh-oh.
Tonight we have Robert J. from Danville.
Woo!
Oh, here we go. I didn't know if we're doing the raffle first. Here's the raffle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh dear. So clip in. All right. I'll get my shit together here in a sec. I think I'm going to hold it. I don't mind a few of you guys to kind of go like this if I start to drop the mic because it just kind of happens. Maybe it's gravity or I don't know. Well, hey guys, my name's Robert Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. Bit nervous. I made some notes. I promise I won't read a bunch of notes, but just a little kind of outline. So, all right, my sobriety date's August 2nd, 2005. I have a sponsor. I've got a new sponsor. I'll talk about that. And I have two sponsees. I check in with them often, and I've got one of these hardcore ass-whooping type of sponsors. And so I check in with him several days a week, and it's exactly what I needed going through what I'm going through right now. So, and he's just been a blessing in my life. So, you know, I, just like you, if you were the freckled kid or the fat kid, you know, I grew up biracial. My mother's French. My father's Black American that was in the service, and he was stationed in France. And they had three kids in France, and they all speak French. And then we moved to, and then with me on the way, we moved to Berkeley. And so we're all dual citizens, and my father is very reclusive and very isolated, and I just was, I don't know who the fuck I was. My mother, we grew up, so my mother spent much time with us, so we grew up very European, very, very much European culture. And I've got, influences of my father, but I'm going to talk a bit about a very dysfunctional childhood, which is, many of us have, and then and I don't think we should be ashamed to talk about that. And then what I do about it in recovery and where that leads me to now. Can everybody hear me okay?
No.
Higher, okay. All right. I've got to keep this like right at my teeth. I'm glad I asked. So, as a young boy, my poor father, he grew up in the Deep South, and many of you guys know in the Deep South, there's no matter what your race was, they whipped the shit out of their kids. And so when we were young, he belt whipped us to bleeding, me and my brothers. And it was very challenging, not knowing when dad was going to have that alcoholic rage. I ran away a lot, and fortunately, I had a lot of friends, and I wouldn't tell them, but I would just get invited and go spend the night, or, I'd find ways, but, 5 and 6 year olds aren't supposed to be having to run away to feel safe. And my mother was such a saint, but she was so fucking codependent, and I've always, until later in life when I was doing Al-Anon, I never could put any blame. But I had an Al-Anon sponsor, a woman Al-Anon sponsor that would say, what woman would call the husband and say the boys were bad for him to come home and beat them like that? And I just, some of us, we grew up in a very, alcoholic, kind of a 360 degree train wreck of alcoholic codependent dysfunction. And I'm certainly not alone. So, I learned where that dysfunction comes from both sides of, from Florida. I later learned my grandmother from France came to live with us several times, and she was fleeing an angry alcoholic who had complications from World War I and gassing. And he was kind of a rager. He didn't beat her, but he was just rageful. And on my father's side, I went twice as a young boy, first when I was 7 years old, on a Greyhound bus to Florida, with my brothers who were smoking weed in the back the whole way, the whole way to Florida. And so we get to Florida, and we're going to meet Grandma drinking beer. And so we arrive in Tallahassee, northern Florida, which is like the deepest part of the South. That's Georgia, Alabama, same area. We get there about 10 o'clock, and we knock on the door, and there are some big-ass spiders on the outside of the house and the screen doors, and I'm only 7. So she greets us, and we're off to bed, and I sleep in a room where Grover, I guess that was her boyfriend at the time, and she had many boyfriends, apparently. But so I'm in the bedroom with Grover, and 2-3 hours in the middle of the night, I wake up and I look, and there's a spider as big as my hand next to my face. And I was always pretty hyper vigilant kid, so I literally bounced from dead asleep to straight up in the air with my hands up. Ah, I'm screaming, and Grover gets up and he hits me with a pillow and knocks me over to the other side of the room because I woke him up and scared him. And so, and I run into the kitchen and I'm just freaked. The spider's just. I've been arachnophobic ever since. And I run into the kitchen, and I shit you not, a big cockroach flies into my natural and goes, brr, and he gets stuck, and it goes, brr, and I just scream bloody murder, and out comes Grandma drinking beer with a switch, which I had no idea what the frick a switch was, and whips me across the back. And so that was my first 2 hours meeting Dad's family and understanding the dysfunction that he came from. Now, she was also funny as hell. on a good day, she had some pretty damn good humor. But, there was one time, and I spent the whole summer there. I was going to be there for 3 months or all the way till when school started. So that was my first, day. One time she was going to whip me for something else, and I run across the street to the little old white lady that lives across the street. And wouldn't you know, I get over there, and that woman whips me too. And I was just like, oh my God, these people in the South, I want to get out of here. So I call my mom and my dad, and they're like, no, you got to stay. But, I realized then that this was an issue that was just, it was cross-cultural. It was very deeply embedded in history and culture in the South, from slavery and everything else. So fortunately, it wasn't a summer where I was whipped all the time. So I spent the rest of that summer tiptoeing around, trying to stay out of trouble. So, my father, he had a great job. We grew up, I started first grade. We moved to Berkeley, and then we moved to Walnut Creek by first grade. And, he provided for us. He spoke impeccable English. He never swore once, and there's a very traumatic story. I won't go into it. But he spoke impeccable English. He was always pushing college, and he was really hardworking. So my brothers would take off on the weekends, and I was stuck doing yard work with him. But he really taught me how to do irrigation and plumbing and landscaping. And, to this day, I love getting after it. When I had a big home in Alamo, I did all my lawns and all that work. And so he taught me a lot, and I'm grateful. My mother taught me service. She was an incredible cook. Despite all the dysfunction, she was loving. And I'm so grateful for what I had. So I went to high school at Las Lomas. My brothers got me. I guess my first drink was getting high. Towards the end of eighth grade, in summer of eighth grade. And that was my last sober breath till I was 42, pretty much, give or take a few days here and there. So I get to high school, and I was a smart kid, but I was one of those kids that wanted to be everybody's friend. I was very athletic. I played football all 4 years, starting wide receiver. But I loved hanging out with the stoners across the tracks in Las Lomas. That's where I hung. I spent a lot of time. Those were my peeps, right? But the cheerleaders were my peeps. I just wanted everybody to be my friend. And I had a good time in high school. And generally speaking, early on, I think it was my sophomore year. No, it would be my junior year. We were already starting to drink. I was drinking a bit. and I had my first blackout going to a party. Any of you guys had a childhood dream where you wake up and you're naked or in your underwear at school or something like that? Well, some of the popular girls, Joe DiMaggio's granddaughters, of which one of them was my first girlfriend growing up in Walnut Creek, had a party. And everybody was there, and all the football team, and I was, you know, everybody there. And I proceeded to, we're drinking hard liquor, and I got in the hot tub, and you kind of know where that story goes. So I ended up getting out, taking my clothes off, and I'm walking around the party. Fortunately, I didn't walk around the whole party, but I walked around, you know, and I get that call the next day, like, dude. And I buried that memory so deep. I shoved that memory for decades. It was gone until way later, and I started doing my step work. But that's when, I mean, right then I was starting to control my drinking, because every time I drank hard liquor, I was part of the story. It was always a funny story. I was dancing on the table. I was doing something, but it was going to be a story. So, you know, I'm what you would describe as a maintenance drinker. And, you know, that's kind of how my drinking progressed. I was a beer drinker, and I just have to have my maintenance drink every day. I want to talk briefly about a special teacher. Denise has heard this story a million times, but if you guys will allow me. In my junior year, I had a creative writing class, and there was this one teacher that, he just gave a shit about me, you know, and I felt pretty lost in high school, wanting everybody to be my friend. And he just spent a little extra time with me. I was too high to get A's or B's, you know. I was a C and B student, you know, it was okay. I got an A in his class. He spent extra time with me, and he would talk about trekking with the Dalai Lama and backpacking and hiking, and I was super into the outdoors. And for some reason, just it doesn't matter how a teacher or an angel touches somebody, he touched a kid. And I got out of high school, and I went to DVC. And some switch, academic switch, went off, and I was a straight-A student. And I could just do school at some point. And just, it was follow the script. You know, just school was pretty easy for me. I could just do that, get an A. But every time when there was midterms or finals and a break was coming, and I'd have two joints rolled, and I would be at a liquor store within seconds of that last midterm or final. It was just like on. I ended up going to undergraduate at one of the state universities in the same dynamic. I studied accounting and went on to be a CPA. And just like when finals or midterms were done, you know, I was blessed to have jobs with the top accounting firms in the country, and then I moved into management consulting with one of the top firms. Very privileged to have these great positions. And I became an alcoholic like what's described on page 21 of our big book. He had a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when an important engagement must be kept. Right? I have that sick, self-sabotaging je ne sais quoi. But many times when I was a management consultant and I did all kinds of great research and worked with teams, and we'd have a presentation the next day, or I'd have a presentation, and I could just tell myself, and I do good work, you know, even if I was coming partially, you know, buzzed, you know, I never drank during the job at this point. But it was right when that particularly important engagement, and I would tell myself, just go fucking home. You've done the work. Just go home. Go to sleep. Come to work. Pull it off. Then you can go drink. And when you know, I don't know if you guys, but I could feel it in the back of my neck. There was no way I was going to make it home. I'd end up drinking 10 beers on the way home or whatever it was. I made it to work the next day, but I was poisoned. And that defined my drinking. I just had a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when an important engagement be kept. So, I went on to, I was blessed to go on to a fine graduate school back east in Cambridge, Massachusetts, later on in my life, and about 10 years afterwards. And that same pattern took place. You know, I was a great student, did great graduate work, wrote a thesis, published it, but I constantly was fighting that alcoholic boogeyman. And I had the pick of jobs coming out of grad school, and I was so fortunate and so grateful, and wouldn't you know, I couldn't even show up the first day without being poisoned. You know, it was just that constant, you know, just can't show up. I would show up, but I'd always kind of, I wasn't at my best, not even close. So that kind of defied how I drank. where do I want to go? After grad school, I had, you know, great jobs, and the same pattern of, you know, drinking persisted. I like to, you know, after work, I would drink in the car. I was a car drinker. And my poor wife, I met my college sweetheart. I was 20, she was 17, we ended up getting married. And we've always had a great relationship, and to this day are still wonderful friends. But I would come home, at least 3 or 4 beers, probably 6 or 7 on the average, and that has lasted for 20 years. You know, that pattern of drinking was just, it just, like all of us, it just gets worse and worse. Eventually I got a sales job where I could start drinking earlier in the day, and I got to the point where I found myself drinking earlier than 5, then earlier than 4, then earlier than 3, then earlier than 2. And it was a time when I drank at noon and just prior to noon when I just, the bells were starting to go off because I knew, I'd always just kind of instinctively know you start morning drinking and you're an alcoholic. And so I was just starting subconsciously to try to put up, I knew nothing about recovery, I knew nothing about AA, but I was starting to get very depressed about not having the control of my drink. That was about 2003. We bought a nice home in Alamo, and oh, actually a year prior to that, I came home from work, and I was really drunk at 10 o'clock at night, and my ex came down, and by that time we had our daughter Maya, who is here with us, and she said, you know, and with Maya kind of right behind her, she was only 4 at the time, or just turned 5, and then she ran back upstairs, she didn't know. I wasn't angry, I was just kind of drunk. But she said something that just hit me across the face like a 4x4, and it was, if you were Maya, you think she'd choose you as your dad, as her dad? And man, that was a moment of truth. That was the point that, because I knew, it was just, I grew up, I never beat my kids knew I loved them and everything else, but doesn't matter when you're 4, 5, 6, 8, whatever it is, you're not present. You are an alcoholic. And I knew that's not the dad that I wanted to be. And I'm so glad that she said that, because at that moment, I really was starting to put the brakes on. Maya was 5. I would stop 2 years later. And that's when I was starting to drink, you know, and I had that drink at, you know, around noon. And there was a couple more things that led to my bottom. I had a sales job, and I was Western United States rep for E-Trade. I'd left commercial real estate finance, which is where I was working, and in investment management, and I was helping E-Trade grow its Western mortgage banking business. And I drunk dialed a client. I was on a fishing trip coming back from Humboldt, and I was, at that point, I think I called him, I was in Santa Rosa. And that good man talked me home all the way from Santa Rosa to Danville, to Alamo. And the whole left side of our car was thrashed, so he probably heard me hitting something. He should have called the police, you know, because I could have killed somebody. He called to check on me the next day. He was concerned, but laughed a little bit, but he was also concerned. You know, and I don't know what I said. And we stayed in touch and we did some more business, but I certainly was trying to put the brakes on at that point. And that didn't stop me. I still kept on. And then one time I went to go see a client in Emeryville. And it's easy to get in the wrong lane and be committed to going across the Bay Bridge. I wasn't paying attention. And I was in the right lane. I'm stuck on the Bay Bridge, so I knew I was going to have to go to Angel Island and turn around. So I turn around and I bump into somebody who started on the freeway, and then she stopped right in the middle of the freeway as she's accelerating, and I barely bumped her. So what did I do? I know I didn't do any damage, but I drove off. And like a good old alcoholic, I drove to Oakland. And I'm like, this is getting dicey. And they parked my car in a parking garage. I proceeded to rent a car. And I'm going to go home with a rental car back to my little sweethearts in Alamo. But no, I had to stop and get another six-pack, right, because I needed a cocktail. Oh, and I had a couple cocktails when I bumped into that woman in the car, a couple empties. So that's the fucking sick thinking of an alcoholic. I mean, just that's not enough for me to like wake up and not drink anymore that night. But, you know, was I a chronic alcoholic? Did I drink a handle? No. But it doesn't matter how much you drink. I still needed that 3, 4, 5, 6 beers no matter what, and I'd do anything to do it. I get home, tell a lie to my sweet wife, and a cop shows up about 10 o'clock at night. And I got that, because she's like, what's that car? And I'm, my car or something. I don't even know what I said. We lie. And that cop, he gave me a look. Never forget that look. And my ex gave me that look. And we all know what that look like, don't we? Who knows that look? And within a couple of days, by noon, I was about ready to go get a drink during a Monday, or I think it was a Tuesday, August 2nd, 2005. And I ran to a noon, I'd looked it up, I ran into a noon meeting, and I raised my hand and I said, I'm Robert, I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, I just felt that obsession to drink lift from my shoulders that moment. And I've not had the need to take a drink since. Now, mind you, I would sneak a beer if my ex asked me to go to Safeway, 3-minute, 4-minute drive. I'd sneak a beer there and sneak a beer back. I mean, I constantly had I was obsessing, where's my next drink? So for that obsession to be gone, my first meeting was, I know it was just an incredible blessing, but I'd been battling knowing that I'm just fighting, losing battle, and I'd been praying. And you know, that last year, ever since she told me about, you know, my daughter's story, and then shortly after, I started having vivid dreams, and I started praying like, God, help me. And I was really praying after the accident, and I was having these vivid dreams of I'm going to jail, a terrible, horrific crash. And I honestly think that was God's service to me. I feel like God put those dreams, those vivid dreams. I'd wake up sweating, you know, and I just knew my shit, my end is coming, or even worse than crashing and killing myself, it was some little lady backs out, it's her fault, I bump into her, or I hit her hard, whatever, and I'm going to jail, because I fear jail more than everything. But it was constant, every few days, several days a week, and I just knew this is where I'm heading. So that's how I started my journey. My first sponsor, man, I had a hardcore sponsor that I needed. And you know, for the newcomers, man, I hope that you're able to just take our hand, try not to run the show. He was on my shit. He was like, I want you to call 4 to 6, 7 men a day. I want you to speak to at least 3. And that fucker would call them and he'd find out. For a year. He would absolutely be in my shit if I lied. But he knew my story. He knew my dad's story. My father never had a friend visit our entire lives. Ever. Not a friend, not a peer. We have to connect. And he had to get through this arrogant fuck's head that I can't think my way through this. I have to follow direction. I had a grand sponsor that would tell me, what time do we go till? 9:05? Grand sponsor would tell me, you realize you're crazy yet? You realize your first thought's wrong? And he would just tell me all this stuff, and I'd just be, he said this, and I drive home. He doesn't know who he's talking about. When are you going to be a fuck-up like everybody else? Right? When are you going to be just one of us? When are you going to tell everybody you're lonely and you're depressed? And all that, he was just... And I needed all that because he was right. And I just needed to be transparent. And that's some of the most sacred wisdom I've ever been given in Alcoholics Anonymous is be transparent. Let people know what's going on. We're as sick as our secrets. We're as sick as our secrets. You know, so that sponsor, later I had a horrible emotional bottom as our marriage was starting to come apart. And my first sponsor just, he wasn't very good with, you know, relationships. So I won't go into that story, but I end up going to a Saturday meeting called Roadrunners, Saturday, 7 a.m., and a young friend of mine, not a young friend, a friend from high school, Los Lomas, says, hey, do you know that man? That's Gordon Lindsay. Now, we're having a separation. My 27-year marriage is coming undone. I'm suicidal. We're going to lose our home in Alamo. My world is just coming down. And there's my high school English teacher in a meeting, the angel. That if it wasn't for him, I'd never have gone to MIT. And Gordon grew up from in a very dysfunctional Mormon family. His father beat the shit out of him just like my father did, with all kinds of religious fundamental. It doesn't matter, right? It's just father raged on him, and he had all kinds of problems. And Gordon was saved by a man named Happy Jack, which many of you guys might have heard about. He was the most loving man, and that man was an orphaned, and he had, part of his story was watching his mother at 12 or 13 years old drive away with another man and leave him and abandon him for the rest of his life. And Happy Jack spoke so eloquently and taught so many men how to love at depth, starting with loving themselves. And so my sponsor said, I want you to back down your AA program. I want you to work on your codependency because you're going to die codependent. Work on your adult child issues. And so I had to work a couple programs. And that taught me to love myself, man. And it just, I spent all my savings trying to hold on to her. I did all kinds of things that only a codependent would do, but I didn't know what that was. And so sometimes in the program, we have to go and do some more work. And learning to love myself was the best gift I could ever get in recovery. But 30 years later, that same angel comes and saves my life. And I just think that is such a blessing that we have. And sometimes we go through life and we don't see our angels. And they're everywhere. You know, so something I'd like you guys to think about tonight is, am I missing signals? Am I missing signs? Am I being grateful for those that are in my life? Am I grateful for those that have had an impact on my life? You know, today I'm blessed. I have the most amazing woman in my life. I love so much, and she's just my rock, a life partner. And I'm just so honored to have her in my life. I've got two wonderful kids that are just amazing. So far we don't have any alcoholics in the house, so I'm just like, wow, I thought for sure we'd, because it comes from both sides of my family and my exes as well. So, but you know, I'm blessed. I've learned so much to be a better father, a better husband. This program means so much to me. And right now I've been going through a kind of a career reboot. And I recognized, man, I am not working this program like it's meant to be worked. I mean, like hardcore working the program. And so I had to go and find me a real sponsor that would cut through my bullshit, you know. I swear to God, man, you can be too rich, which I'm not, for this program, or you can be too educated or too smart for this program, which I think I am bedeviled by. And I constantly have to catch myself grabbing the wheel. And what I thought was a good program, I was still going through something that clearly I was not connected with my higher power and I'm not thriving in my life. And so that's been a real challenge for me, is to really, really work intensely in this program, going through page zero, working with sponsors, spending hours a week in the book, and now I'm starting taking one of my first sponsees through the book as well. And it's just a wonderful new connection I'm having with the program, which I've always been part of. But sometimes we have to just double it down. And I know I'm not the only one that's had to reboot his program, you know, in the near 20 years of his sobriety, but this alcoholic certainly is getting after it right now. So, you know, it's been an honor to speak with you guys. I hope I wasn't too quiet and forgetting to put this damn thing at my face. So I think that's about enough for me, and thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend.